This message comes from NPR sponsor Be My Guest with Ina Garten, a podcast from Food Network. Intimate and captivating conversations with new and old friends. Jennifer Garner, Frank Bruni, Emily Mortimer, and more. Listen to Be My Guest wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest today is crime writer S.A. Cosby. He spoke with our producer, Sam Brigger, about his new novel, All the Sinners Bleed. Here's Sam.
In the new novel, All the Sinners Bleed, by our guest S.A. Cosby, Sheriff Titus Crown is tracking down a serial killer terrorizing his jurisdiction, Charon County, a fictional county in southeast Virginia. The killer's victims are black children. As he investigates, Titus unravels the racial and religious animus behind the killings. Titus had left Charon County to go to college and to work with the FBI investigating domestic terrorism. But after that career abruptly ended, he reluctantly returned to live with his aging father. Titus was elected the first black sheriff of Charon, a remarkable achievement considering the prevalence of Confederate flags in the area, the high school named after Jefferson Davis, and a statue honoring the Confederate cause outside the courthouse. Titus has to figure out a way to keep the county safe from the serial killer and also keep simmering racial tensions from getting out of hand, especially as a white supremacist group is planning to march in support of what it calls, quote, Southern heritage. S.A. Cosby has written several crime novels, including the bestseller Razorblade Tears and Blacktop Wasteland. Razorblade Tears appeared on many Best of the Year lists in 2021. Cosby, whose first name is Sean, grew up in Matthews County, a place very much like the fictional Charon County, and now lives nearby. Well, Sean Cosby, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'd like to start with the prologue to your book, if you could do a reading for us. And this sort of sets up what Charon County is like and some of its history.
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. Charon County. Charon County was founded in bloodshed and darkness, literally and figuratively. Even the name is enveloped in shadows and morbidity. Legend has it that the name of the county was supposed to be Charlotte or Charles, but the town elders waited too late, and those names were already taken by the time they decided to incorporate their fledgling encampment. As the story goes, they just moved their finger down the list of names until they settled on Charon. Those men, weathered as wit leather, with hands like splitting mauls, bestowed the name on their new town with no regard to its macabre nature. Or perhaps they just liked the name because a river flowed through the county and emptied into the Chesapeake like the River Styx. Who knows? Who could know the thoughts of those long dead men? What is known is that in 1805, in the dead of night, a group of white landowners, chafing at the limits of their own manifest destiny, set fire to the last remaining indigenous village on the teardrop-shaped peninsula that would become Charon County. Those who escaped the flames were brought down by muskets with no regard to age, gender, or infirmity. And that was the first of many tragedies in the history of Charon. There was the cannibalism of the winter of 1853, the malaria outbreak of 1901, the United Daughter of the Confederacy picnic poisoning of 1935, the Danforth family murder-suicide of 1957, the tent revival baptismal drownings of 1968, and on and on and on. The soil of Charon County, like most towns and counties in the South, was sown with a generation of tears.
That's S.A. Cosby reading from his new book, All the Sinners Bleed. So, Sean, I really thought that was interesting, the sort of idea that the county is founded in bloodshed and darkness, and that somehow that history has haunted the place or tainted it. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a Southerner born and bred. I was raised in Virginia. I was born in Matthews County. I've lived my whole life, 30 miles from the former capital of the Confederacy. If there's a place that is more haunted by its past and more overwhelmed by its original sin than the South, I'm not aware of it. The South is in many ways, the birthplace of the country, but it's also a microcosm for what's wrong with the nation. And so I'm a big proponent of the idea that maybe the South isn't, supernaturally haunted, but it is definitely haunted by the pain and the bloodshed and the violence that existed here.
Do you sort of see that haunting whenever you're walking around or driving around where you live?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can definitely feel it. You can feel it, you know. For years, our local elementary school was Lee Jackson School, named after Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. And, you know,
one,
I went to school
one name there. Wasn't enough.
Yeah, one Confederate statue, one Confederate soldier wasn't enough. We had to really hammer home the point of what we're trying to say here. And so, you know, as a kid, I went to school there. I was taught that the Civil War was the War of Northern Aggression. I was taught that the Civil War wasn't technically, if you squint, about slavery. And so those are things that are still being taught to a different, to a certain extent in my hometown today. I think, you know, somebody said to me one time that the difference between the South and post-World War II Germany is that Germans are ashamed of their history and Southerners aren't ready to accept it. And I think that's a, I think that has a lot of validity.
We'll get to some of that a little bit later. But first, you know, I read that you originally set out to write a book about police brutality, but then you shifted and you're the hero of this book is actually a sheriff. What brought about that evolution?
So, and this book was really inspired by the murder of George Floyd and all the events of that summer. And I really wanted to take a book and talk about policing, but use it in, like I said before, the microcosm of a small town to reflect the issues and concerns about policing on a larger scale. And what I realized rather quickly is that I did not have enough wherewithal to write about that in a really, truly unbiased fashion. I'm too personally involved in it. I've been pulled over for driving while black before. I've had my face shoved in the asphalt for no reason, just because I was driving a nice car. And so there was a lot of emotion there that I wasn't able to pull back from. And when you write like that, I think you end up sermonizing. Nobody wants a 300-page sermon. You know, you want a good story. And so I set the book aside for a while, and I didn't think about it. And I had a conversation with a friend of mine who was a former minister. He said something that really struck me. He said, you know, the thing that bothered me the most is when I was a minister, I didn't feel like I actually was helping the least of us, the people who needed my help the most. And that sort of sparked this idea in me about a character who's trying to do that. I didn't want to write about it from the point of view of a minister, just because I felt like writing about the police and writing about a sheriff, I could sort of accomplish on a smaller scale the things I had originally set out to do. So I can talk about policing, but I can talk about religion. I can talk about sex. I can talk about class. You know, those are, in my opinion, the four pillars of Southern fiction, because Southern fiction is so intrinsically tied up with those issues, with religion, with sex, with class. And those things are intrinsic in the work of Faulkner or Flannery O'Connor or Harry Cruz or Carson McCullers or Ernest J. Gaines. You see all of that all the time. And it's always in flux in their books. And so I decided I was going to try to write a book like that.
He wants to obviously keep law and order in his county, but also in his personal life, like his closet is color coordinated and his desk, like his, I don't know if it's his phone has to be like 90 degrees to mm-hmm. the desk. So he's, and I think he's trying to keep the chaos out of his life as well. Like this is a character that's dealing with a lot of pain and trauma, like both from personal losses, particularly the loss of his mother when he was young. But also I think because he's like living in this place, he's a black man living in this place that was part of the Confederacy and where some of the residents still believe in white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. The hero isn't always the person who does the over the top angelic Greek mythology heroic thing. Sometimes the hero is the person who just stands up and say, all right, I'll do it. You know, and so with Titus, that's sort of what happened with him. He wanted to change the police force in his hometown. He had to come home and he saw things that he didn't like and nobody else was standing up to do it. And so he finally did it. And what he finds out is that, you know, being the hero can sometimes make you a pariah. You know, in his town, he has friends that he went to school with, went to high school with, that no longer speak to him because he's the sheriff. But on the other side, he has white citizens who are apologists for the Confederacy, who don't, quote unquote, trust him because he's a black man. And so he finds himself sort of a man alone, a man on an island. But yet he still is dedicated to protecting his hometown, protecting the people there, even the people that he, as he said, didn't vote for him. And I think that says a lot about Titus and his morality. And I think that in a way, Titus is a little naive. He really believes if I just apply the law equally, then the law will be equal. And, you know, he's working within a system that I think he thinks is broken, that a lot of people think is working just the way it's designed. And so that sort of conflict is, to me, interesting as a writer. I want to see how that character deals with it. I found myself feeling sorry for Titus because he really is doing the best he can.
So as I mentioned earlier, Sean, in your book, there's a statue commemorating the Confederate cause. It stands in front of the courthouse. It's actually not even like a real person. It's just called Old Rebel Joe. And in the book, you write about like how this statue and others like it were erected in the South by this group, the United Daughters of the Confederacy. I was hoping you could read that passage for us about the history of these statues.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you. Titus pulled out of the parking lot and slipped onto the road. Night had come and covered the sky above Cheyenne County like a black blanket full of pinpricks. He turned right and drove past the courthouse building. Ricky Sowers and his neo-Confederates had installed solar lights around the statue of Old Rebel Joe. Titus thought the lights looked cheap and disposable, much like the statue itself. It had been erected in 1923 by the United Daughters of the Confederacy, a part of a coordinated and extensive propaganda campaign to reframe traitors as patriots. After World War I, thousands of black veterans had returned home after saving democracy from the Kaiser with a renewed sense of dignity. They were heroes, after all. Why should they have to bow and scrape to anybody? Then the Red Summer happened, and white men, like Everett Cunningham, Scott's great-grandfather, made it their mission to remind these heroes of their place.
So, Sean, did you know about that history before researching for the book, or did you come across it then?
Yes and no. My grandfather, my great-grandfather was a World War I vet, so I knew a little bit about the Red Summer. As far as the Confederate statues, I had a little bit of that history, but I had found it much later in researching another book, and I was just fascinated by the idea that some 20, 30-odd years after the Civil War and after the history of the country was adjudicated, these folks took it upon themselves to reframe the Civil War. And I think that's a horrible, horrible thing that we're still dealing with today, that we are not able to accept the truth of our history, not just the Civil War, but of, you know, America's history in total. You know, the idea of America is this incredible, wonderful experiment in freedom and autonomy. But the way we got there is filled and littered with, you know, darkness and degradation. And I think we do ourselves a disservice if we're not honest about it. It's funny. I'll hear a lot of people say, you know, we can't take these statues down. And these people were just people of their time. And, you know, they were fighting for what they thought was right. You know, and I'm like, yeah, and I'm sure Nazis thought they were right, too. That doesn't make it correct. You know, I'll hear people sometimes, especially nowadays, you hear people say, oh, you're trying to make, you know, young white children feel guilty about what their ancestors did. Well, if they don't share those same sentiments, why would they feel guilty? You know, it's that maddening fallacy of logic that drives me crazy sometimes.
Yeah, knowing that the history of these statues, that they were part of this like propaganda campaign after World War I, like really to subjugate black people, like what does that do to the arguments that some make about how honoring the Confederacy or even displaying the Confederate flag is just a way to celebrate Southern heritage, that it's not tethered to the history of slavery or white supremacy?
I think that's an incredibly naive, if not outright disingenuous attitude. You can't separate those two. You know, I am a Southerner. My Southern bona fides go back to 1867. My great-great-great-grandfather, Gabriel Cosby, and his brother Kit Cosby founded the church that I attended for a number of years. When you wave that Confederate flag and tell people that that's Southern heritage, what you're doing is erasing all the indigenous people that live in the South, all the black people that live in the South, the huge amount of Jewish Southerners that live in the South. What you're saying is that only one demographic's interpretation of history matters. And, you know, I am a proud Southerner. I have no intention of leaving. And every scrap of land or every pole that some good old boy erects to put a Confederate flag on, someone who looks like me has bled and died and lived there. And I have as much right to Southern heritage as anyone else. And so I don't plan on ceding one inch, one foot, one iota to someone who has this sort of reimagined revisionist idea of what the Civil War was.
There is a similar statue in Matthews County where you grew up. Is that still there or has that been taken down?
No, it's still there. We had there was a referendum on the election board a few years ago to take it down, and the folks who were in favor of it staying up were successful in wording the referendum in such a confusing way. I think people didn't realize what exactly they were voting for, and they messaged it as, oh, they're trying to take away our history and all that. And again, that's frustrating to me. History is, you can have history in museums. That doesn't mean you forgot it. Those statues are not up for historical reasons. Those statues are reminders that the people who fought a whole war to keep people in chains do not accept their loss. And I think that's something that, again, has really worn us down as a people, as a nation, that we did not take action to make the people who were literal traitors be treated like traitors. We let the, you know, I think it's the first time in the history of the world that the losers of a civil conflict were able to dictate the terms of how they remembered. And so I find that frustrating, not only as a Southerner, but as an African-American. You know, the one in Matthews, the statue of Matthews is built directly in front of what used to be the courthouse building. And that's a very clear message that, you know, if you come here for redress of grievances, you'll find yourself wanting, because this is what we think of you. And so, you know, it's funny, in my hometown, I had a gentleman that I knew, a white gentleman, who was like, you know, I don't know why y'all are getting all upset about that statue now. I never heard about it when I was a kid. And I wanted to turn to him, like, when you were a kid, people were being lynched. You know, you're 68. When you were a child, speaking out against the statue could get you shot in the face. And so I definitely write about that, you know, in my work, not just all the centers, but all my work. I talk about race. I talk about the way that we are slowly but surely trying to understand what it means to be Southern in the 21st century. You know, and I find that, you know, I love the South. I really do. I love where I come from. I love the place that I live. But to paraphrase James Baldwin, because I love the South, I reserve the right to criticize it because I know it can be better than what it is.
So later in the book, there's this white supremacist group led by like this wonderfully named character, Ricky Sowers. And they hold a march to protect the statue, even though it doesn't seem like there's a plan to remove it. And Titus, your hero, actually has to protect their right to march, and they're marching in Confederate uniforms. And you write, like, what he thinks when he looks at them. You say, he felt an atavistic revulsion roll through his body. The sight of these men who thought their lack of complete success in their every endeavor was proof of the falsity of their privilege and their dress grays, made him sick. And I really think that description, men who thought their lack of complete success in their every endeavor was proof of the falsity of their privilege, is really interesting. I was hoping you could talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, so I've had debates with people I considered friends or people I knew or people I grew up with that this idea of white privilege doesn't exist. You know, there's no such thing. It's like I had a gentleman tell me, I'm working every day. You know, I'm paying bills. How is that? Where's my privilege? Where's my free car? And privilege is not free things. I think people confuse privilege with success. You know, just because you're not successful doesn't mean that you're not privileged. It's like you can be in a foot race and your mom can be the one judging the foot race and your brother can give you a 10-foot head start. And if you lose, that doesn't mean that you didn't have any privileges. You know, just mean you weren't able to take advantage of them. And so I think there's this idea among some folks that, you know, their lack of success is a proof that the privilege doesn't exist. No, your privilege is to drive down the road without getting pulled over for nothing. You know, your privilege is to go into a store and have a $20 bill that looks a little janky and the person just not accepting it. You don't end up with somebody's knee on your neck. You know, that's your privilege. Your privilege is to have an uncle, have a cousin, have a friend, have a fraternity brother who works at a bank, who gets you a good mortgage when you come in, even though maybe your credit isn't 100%. That's your privilege. Now, if you lose the house later on, that, again, it's not emblematic of not having that privilege. And so I definitely am aware of that. It's something that I've seen growing up, you know, as a kid in the South. When I was 13, I won a chess contest at our school. We had like a chess tournament. And there was a kid, I'm not going to name him, obviously, but there was a kid who didn't play chess, who didn't like chess, but he was mad that I had won. And I was on the school bus with him, and he poured some liquid on me, and we got into a fight, you know, as kids do. And, you know, when the principal asked him, why did he do it? He was just mad that I won the contest. He was tired of people talking about how smart I was and all that kind of stuff. And I remember turning to him and I'm like, but you don't like chess. And at the time as a child, I couldn't wrap my mind around that, you know. And as an adult, I realized that this particular young man was in a household where anything that wasn't whiteness centered was taken as an insult, was taken as a slight. That itself is a privilege to believe it, to feel that, you know, I've never been ashamed of being black. I've never been ashamed of being a black man. But I'm acutely aware that my life has never been easier because of the color of my skin. Just like I have friends who are white, I doubt that their lives have ever been harder because of the color of their skin. And again, I don't want you to feel bad about that. I don't want you to, you know, genuflect and grovel about that. I just want you to acknowledge it. I think acknowledging it goes a long way to help healing some of our issues.
We're listening to the interview our producer Sam Brigger recorded with crime writer S.A. Cosby, author of the new novel, All the Sinners Bleed. His other books include Razorblade Tears and Blacktop Wasteland. After a break, we'll hear more of the interview, and our book critic Maureen Corrigan will share her thoughts on Barbie dolls and the Barbie movie. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Summer is for going to the movie theater because it's too hot to stay home. It's for driving with the windows down, listening to your favorite music. It's for stretching out while you're on vacation to gobble up a TV show. For a guide to some of the TV, movies, and music we are most excited about this summer, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Hi, this is Molly C.V. Nesper, producer at Fresh Air.
And this is Seth Kelly, also a producer at Fresh Air.
If you like the Fresh Air podcast, we think there's a pretty good chance that you'll also like the Fresh Air newsletter.
It's a weekly newsletter written by us, the people who help make the show.
You'll get all the week's interviews and reviews in one place, plus staff recommendations, interviews from the archive, bonus audio, and what's coming up on the show.
Imagine an email you enjoy getting.
To subscribe, go to whyy.org/Fresh Air.
Let's get back to the interview our producer Sam Brigger recorded with writer S.A. Cosby. His new novel is called All the Sinners Bleed. The action takes place in a fictional county in southeast Virginia called Charon County, which is a lot like the county Cosby grew up in, where the high school was named after Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, and where a statue in front of the courthouse honors the Confederate cause. His novel's hero is Titus Crown, Charon County's first black sheriff.
So you grew up in southeast Virginia in Matthews County, a place that sounds very similar to the Charon County of your book. Could you tell us about where you grew up, your family, your home?
Yeah. Oh, man. So Matthews County, it is Charon. I'll just be honest with you. I just changed the name so nobody gets mad at me. But no, I love Matthews County. Matthews County is the smallest county in Virginia. Population hovers around 8,000 people. And I know all of them. So which made dating difficult in high school because you related to everybody. It's like, oh, I met this girl. She's your cousin. Oh, okay. Never mind. So we had to go next door to Gloucester to date. But it's a beautiful, beautiful place to live. It's right on the Chesapeake Bay. You know, there are farms there. There's the sea is a huge part of our lives. My dad was a waterman or a commercial fisherman when I was a kid. My grandmother worked at the seafood plant where they picked crab meat and shelled oysters and scallops. You know, my grandfather, like I said, he was an elder in our church. He was a man that I looked up to a lot. Sunday evenings, people come after church to my grandma's house, and they would just sort of casually gather there. And my grandmother would go get some hamburger meat, or she'd have some venison steaks. And somebody would cook, and then invariably somebody would find a jug of moonshine or a jar and pass that around. And I grew up around these really interesting backyard orators and these really interesting barbecue raconteurs. My uncles and my aunts told, just this history of oral storytelling that I grew up around that I really love, and my uncles would tell stories and my aunts would always be like, always say, that's a lie. And my uncle, Edward, would say, well, if it ain't true, it ought to be. And so and so just this joy of telling stories, of telling jokes.
So what were the books that your mom or other people in your family read?
I grew up in a household where people read a lot. My mom read biographies and historical novels, and she read Greek mythology. And she used to make my brother and I, we didn't have a lot of money growing up, but whenever we did get some extra money, she wouldn't just give it to us as an allowance. She would make us solve riddles. Hmm. And I remember my brother was like 15. He was like, I'm getting a job.
it's too much.
It's too much mental acuity going on here. But my mom read those books. My grandmother was a huge romance novel fan. So I read all these Harlequin romances.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Learned to look up words that I didn't understand. So, you go right to the dictionary. Like, what does two messet mean? And like, oh, okay. And then my own. And my uncle, respectively, read horror novels and detective novels.
Yeah.
My aunt gave me my first Stephen King novel, my first Clive Barker novel. And my uncle gave me all of his John D. McDonald, Travis McGee novels. So The Deep Blue Something, and I love those stories. And I remember my aunt, when she gave me my first Stephen King novel, Salem's Lot, I was 13. And she said, hey, you gonna be able to handle this? I'm like, yeah, I'll be fine. She said, I don't want your mom to get mad at me. I was like, all right. And I read the book. And then for the next 2 weeks, I slept with this popsicle crucifix that I made under my pillow because I was so afraid Ralphie Glick was coming to my window.
So, Shauna, you said something just a second ago about how in Matthews County there's 8,000 people. You know all of them. And that's kind of what it seems like in your book, that everyone knows each other. Many people are each in each other's business. You even know, like, who all the white supremacists are. And, like, everyone drinks at this one bar, like all the white people, all the black people. And, unsurprisingly, there's a lot of bar fights there. Is that what it was like living there?
Yeah. it is. I think it's because I think the South, in many ways, the South was forced to acknowledge their horrible past and segregation. And so in doing so, we are more accustomed to being around each other, I think, in a way that if you go to, a certain neighborhood in New York, for instance, you don't have that sort of forced reclamation. And I think it's a good thing. I think it's good that we were forced to do that because I think it helps move things along as well as things can be moving along. But yes, there's a bar here. I won't name them, but there's a local bar here that everybody ends up at. And as people want to do when they had a little bit too much of the libations, they have a tendency to adjudicate disagreements with their fists. And I used to be a bouncer there, so I saw a lot of that.
Yeah, I think you've actually admitted to getting a few of those fights yourself.
I am currently 3-0, so.
Titus's mother was a big churchgoer, but he stopped going to church after she died, and he's no longer a believer. Like your main character, you lost your faith when you were pretty young. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, so like Titus, my mother had a physical disability. My mother had spinal stenosis, and it caused her to have physical disabilities and some difficulty walking and so on and so forth. And I remember a specific incident when I was about 9 or 10. We went to a revival meeting, a tent revival, basically. And there was a guy there who was supposed to be a faith healer. And even though my mom was a little bit skeptical, she was at a point where, her physical capabilities were eroding and rather quickly. And so, like anybody, she, decided what was the harm to go to one of these events. And I remember we were standing in line to get in. And at the time, she wasn't using the wheelchair. She had two canes that she was walking on. And there were a couple of gentlemen smoking cigarettes out front. And my mom used to smoke. And by this time, she had quit. But whenever she saw somebody with a cigarette, she would always get that old urge. And she said to make comment of those guys smoking. And so then later, when we were in the tent revival, and the minister was asking for people to come up on the stage, two of the people that came on stage, one was on crutches, the other one was supposed to be blind, were both those gentlemen that we had seen out front. I remember my mom turning to me. I was a little boy, but she talked to me like I was an adult all the time. She said, well, I see the only thing they're healing is their pockets. And, You know, and then later on, some members of a different church, not my home church, came to pray over my mother in an effort to heal her. And then, you know, when that didn't work, they made an assumption, they made an insinuation that she wasn't praying hard enough.
And that she didn't have enough faith.
Yeah. And it really, really upset me. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I was like, you know, I think I was 11 and I'm a mouthy 11-year-old. And I said, you know, that's not true. Because I knew me and my brother had helped her get on her knees to pray. And, you know, both of us holding her arms and guiding her to the ground. And so that really did have a lot to do with how I sort of lost my faith in church as an organization. But I never lost my faith in spirituality. You know, I think the church, little c, is a building. But church, capital C, is a philosophical and spiritual ideal.
So even though Titus doesn't go to church and is critical about institutionalized religion, he can't really get away from his influence. You have this passage where you write, 20 years removed from the last time since he willingly attended a church service, and he still found himself using the jargon of the devout. It never left you, not completely. The cadence, the syncopation, the King James syntax. It was all there waiting to reemerge like 17-year cicadas. So is that your experience? Like, does the language of Bible, like, jump off your tongue?
Yeah, it does sometimes. Especially, like, I grew up in a Pentecostal church. So, mm-hmm. like, I like to say that means our church choir had a bass guitar. So it's a very rhythmic service. And it's not a staid at all. And so you kind of get caught up in it. And you go there and you're sitting there, and, you know, and the cynic in you are like, oh, you know, this is, you know, you're so cynical about, you know, the offering and where's the money going and why mm-hmm. the minister got a new car and all this right. stuff. And then somebody
when
starts
no air conditioning.
Yeah, exactly. Book, yeah. Yeah. We're all working on fans, but the air conditioning only works one out of every couple hours. And, and you know, you sit there and all that. And then somebody gets up and they start singing an old hymn, you know, an old church spiritual. And then all of a sudden you're 11 years old again mm-hmm. and you're standing next to your grandmother and she's dancing and singing and all that comes bubbling up. And it's like it's unbidden. You don't know what's coming, you know. But you know, it's incredible how much of an impact church has had on our lives in the South, but in this black community specifically, mm-hmm. how much it was a backbone of the civil rights movement, how much it's been a backbone of social movements ever since. But again, as I said, how easily that comfort can become a cudgel.
All right, let's take one more break here. If you're just joining us, our guest is author S.A. Cosby, whose new book is called All the Sinners Bleed. More after break. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.
The day's top headlines, local stories from your community, your next podcast binge listen. You can have it all in one place, your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Sean, your wife owns a funeral home in Virginia, and you've worked there in the past. I don't know if you still work there, but you're listed as a staff member on the webpage. What did or what do you do there?
So in the beginning, I did pretty much everything except the stuff that you had to be licensed to do. So I leave that to my wife and her staff. But I washed the cars, I washed the vehicles, washed the hearse, vacuum up, carried the trash, did minor repair stuff around the office, you know, fixing an outlet here and there. I did go and do what's called a body removal or body retrieval. So when a person passed, I was the one that went and picked them up. And so all of that really helped teach me a lot of empathy. Like, you get this when you work in a funeral home, you see people at the worst time of their life, other than something personally happening to them themselves. They've lost someone that's very close to them that means a lot to them. And so watching the way the staff there dealt with people, and when I mean dealt with, I mean you know, empathize with them, console them, comfort them. It really went a long way to me understanding that everybody deserves that. Because some of the people that come there aren't nice. You know, some of the people that come there, because they're in this horrible moment in their life, they can take that out on the staff of the funeral home. And I never saw them raise their voice. I never saw them take advantage of that situation. And so for me as a writer, it went a long way to me looking at my characters, even my horrible characters, like even the character, the killer in this book. You know, I want to empathize with them. And when I say empathize, that doesn't mean I endorse anything they do. And that doesn't mean I sympathize with them. But I want to know what made them that way. How did they get there? And so for me as a writer, it was an invaluable tool, a lesson in this idea of empathy, of understanding, of seeing things from another person's point of view.
Yeah, I was wondering about that because I thought that both in this book, All the Sinners Bleed and Razor Blade, Tears, you have these really affecting passages of people going through very hard moments of grief. And
yeah, I mean, you know, like I wrote, when I wrote Razor Blade Tears, in the process of writing it, my mother was terminally ill. And then with All the Sinners Bleed, I thought I was over that, but I still was processing it, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a scene where Titus is talking about his mother to his girlfriend, Darlene. He talks about how, you know, there's a pain that only a son knows that he feels when his mother can't hug him. Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, my mom, like I said, has several physical disabilities. And toward the end of life, it was really hard for her to put her arms around me. And, you know, there's just this thing that you, as a child, I don't care how old you are, you want your mom to hug you. And, you know, it's one of those moments that I think is unfortunately relatable to everyone.
So in your book, you write that there's a funeral home that serves black clientele and then another that serves white ones, and that funeral homes are the last places in America where segregation is openly tolerated. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I think especially in the South, you know, funeral business, you know, came about, you know, in the wake of the death of Lincoln. Ironically, he was the first president to be taken to different states to be lying in state. And so the idea that, and also the Civil War advanced funeral business, where kids, you know, going from, you know, Amherst, New York down to South Carolina, and they had to get back home. And so it's interesting to me, as someone outside funeral business looking in, that funeral business was also one of the first places that African-Americans were able to find success in the business wise, where, you know, the funeral home, because white people sure didn't want to put hands on a dead black body. And so the funeral home became sort of this economic center in black communities. It was the place that you went to talk to somebody about legal matters, even though that the funeral director wasn't a lawyer. So the funeral business and funeral homes in black communities are very strong. It's a very important part of the community. But that being said, the specter of racism hangs over it, because for years and years and years, you know, it was a gentleman's agreement that white people went to this funeral home and black people went to that funeral. That's broken down a lot in recent years. You see a lot less of that. But, for you know, I won't date myself, but I'm not so old that I don't remember when that was a hard and fast but quiet rule. And so that has changed a little bit, but you still see a lot of that.
You mean like the people that picked up the bodies would automatically take the person to the funeral home corresponding to their race?
Yeah, even further than that, like when the person passed, if it was like a hospital, you know, the nurses who called, they never called a black funeral home, even by mistake. It was always, again, quietly agreed that we're just, this person is going to go to this white funeral home. I think what happened was, with everything, as time moved on, as people intermarried, we had interracial relationships, and just people, you know, getting good sense. It wasn't so much about the social nicety of keeping the races separated, even in death. It became a thing of like, no, we want to celebrate this person's life, and we have a relationship with this funeral home, or we have a relationship with that funeral home, and it's not right. Race-based. It's more
like family has always gone to this mm-hmm. funeral. All right. So you said earlier you've gotten in a few bar fights. I wanted to talk to you, although you say you're not an aggressive person, but it sounds like part of that might have been related to one of your jobs as a bouncer. Yeah. So in the book, your character Titus, he gets into some fights. He also almost gets into a lot of fights. And there's this thing that he does, which you see in movies and stuff, where you kind of the prelude before a fight is sort of getting into someone's personal space, right? And like I just wanted, like, you talk about that moment that, like, when you have two people squaring off, it's kind of this electrifying moment where you don't really know what's going to happen next.
Yeah, I think, especially when I was a bouncer, you saw it a lot. There were confrontations that you could tell were not going to get physical. It was just going to be a lot of talking, a lot of posturing, you know. It's those are the guys that wait till their friends show up and, you know, they're the guys always like, oh, keep, hold me back. You lucky they hold me back. And it's like, and I, you know, I always loved him in that moment when the guy's friends would let him go. It's like, we're not holding back. By all means, continue. In the moment where you, the moment where you know it's going to be an actual physical confrontation is when people stop talking and they're just in each other's personal space. You step into someone's personal space, your nose to nose or your nose or your foreheads are like less than an inch apart, because now it's become almost that flight or flight reaction is going to happen. And that's when you know something's going to go down. The fun thing, and I think it's funny, unless people are professionally trained, and I mean, unless you're trained in combat sports, the fight usually devolves into just rolling around and breathing hard. It's always going to
get out of breath quickly.
Yeah, and everybody's wrestling, and then your shirt's untucked, and you lost a shoe, and finally people separate you. And so, you know, of course, there are confrontations that escalate, you know, there is a type of confrontation where it's just, you know, are you tired? Are you done now? Did you get out your system? Right. And so obviously that would move forward and people would either be kicked out of the bar or they pulled apart and pulled to the other side of the bar and so on and so forth.
So when you were a bouncer, did you have like a move that you like to get someone out or of the bar or like to neutralize someone that you would have to use?
I always found, and it sounds hilarious, I always found a good, especially if you're taller than someone, a good wedgie was good to get them out of the bar. Just grab them by their underpants and pull those up as high as you can, because it disarms them, and they honestly don't know how to react. And by the time they realize what they want to do, you've gotten them outside. So that was my go-to move. I didn't want to get into a slugfest with you. I just wanted to remove you from the situation as fast as possible.
So. Yeah, they probably are never expecting that.
Not at all.
Well, Sean Cosby, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful.
S.A. Cosby's new novel is called All the Sinners Bleed. He spoke with our producer, Sam Brigger. After a break, book critic Maureen Corrigan will share her thoughts about Barbie, the doll, and the movie. This is Fresh Air.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we have very important people on our show and then ask them about very unimportant things. Here's U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
We are also reliably informed that among your enthusiasms, in addition to macroeconomic policy, is mobile games.
There's some truth in that.
Join us for the NPR podcast that considers all the other things. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts. Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Jasmine Morris here from the StoryCorps podcast. Our latest season is called My Way. Stories of people who found a rhythm all their own and marched to it throughout their lives. Consequences and other people's opinions be damned. You won't believe the courage and audacity in these stories. Hear them on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR.
The Barbie movie, directed by Greta Gerwig, is a big topic of conversation this summer. But to a special subset of audience members, girls who played with Barbies, the movie can evoke a lot of pink-tinged feelings. Here's one of those girls, our book critic Maureen Corrigan.
It's a late afternoon in the summer of 1962 in Sunnyside, Queens. People are coming home from work in the city, exiting the nearby subway and walking by us, four little girls sitting on the sidewalk in front of my apartment house. We have our Barbie carrying cases all lined up in a row, the way we imagine our houses will be someday when we grow up. None of us have Barbie's dream house yet, but pooled together, we have lots of clothes, those now vintage clothes. Our ponytailed Barbies were always trading outfits with each other. The iconic black and white bathing suit, the dress with a white chiffon portrait collar, and the black strapless evening gown with long white gloves. The grown-up passers-by sometimes stopped to comment on our sidewalk tableau. Later on, I'll read the work of urban activist Jane Jacobs and realize these kind of random exchanges were part of what she called the ballet of the streets. But back then, they were just annoying intrusions into our play. "I used to sew my doll clothes out of handkerchiefs," sniffed one woman. We ignore her. A man stops to boast that he's been on the Sing Along with Mitch Miller show, which was filmed in Rockefeller Center. Big deal. We ignore him, too. The only interruption we respond to, and quickly, is Ken. One of us has a frisky Ken who likes to knock on the imaginary doors of our doll case houses and try to kiss the Barbie who's foolish enough to answer. Ew! Ken's naughty behavior surely was some sign of pre-adolescent sexuality bubbling up. But back then, pushing kissing Ken out the door is our way of solidifying the all-girl world of pink and possibility we want to remain in for a good long time. Greta Gerwig's Barbie movie is funny, smart, and nuanced from its opening moments, which nail the source of Barbie's enduring appeal, especially to girls like me, whose childhood was spent in a scratchy, skirted, pre-feminist world. In that opening, a godlike narrator, voiced by Helen Mirren, observes that from the beginning of time, girls have played with dolls. But before the advent of Barbie, those dolls were all babies who needed tending. So right. My Betsy Wetsy always needed a diaper change. My Chatty Cathy needed to be taught not to interrupt. And my walking doll, whose name I've forgotten, always needed assistance lumbering around the living room. Before Barbie, playing with dolls was akin to running a combination nursery, rehab, and assisted living facility. But Barbie could fend for herself. Like Nancy Drew, she drove her own roadster and lived in her own dream house, Virginia Woolf's Room of One's Own, painted in pastels. Barbie didn't teach girls to be of service. She taught us the giddy pleasures of a seeming autonomy. Seeming, because Barbie's autonomy, which the film hilariously depicts in its opening version of Barbie Land, is limited to the gender norms of pre-second wave feminism, encased in pink bubble wrap. The already celebrated, or notorious, depending on your politics, monologue towards the end of the film is delivered by actress America Ferrera, who plays a harried working mother. She addresses the Barbies now under the boot of a Ken-driven patriarchal counter-revolt. And her take on the contradictions and limitations of gender equality in the real world is the wised-up version of what I thought Barbie was showing me as a kid. Yes, Barbie is a beautiful image of ersatz freedom, but it's a freedom we non-plastic women must still fight for. Eventually, my childhood Barbie's world expanded, and so did mine. She bounced from job to job, doctor, astronaut, and acquired lots more fabulous clothes, many of which can be seen in the recent reprint of a wonderful book, Dressing Barbie, by Carol Spencer, who was one of the doll's early fashion designers. I was about 13 when my mother told me I had to give my Barbie away. She said I was too old for dolls. When the Barbie movie opened this weekend, my husband, adult daughter, and I nabbed tickets for a 9 a.m. show on Sunday morning. Even while I was happy to be with my family, deep down, I was fantasizing about what it would have been like to see the film with my old Barbie. She would have loved it and wouldn't have needed me to explain the insider jokes. We could have even shared some plastic popcorn and talked about what outfits to wear to the next phase of the feminist revolution.
Maureen Corrigan is a professor of literature at Georgetown University. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll remember Tony Bennett and listen back to excerpts of interviews I recorded with him dating back to 1982 about his life and music. And we'll hear recordings that exemplify why he was one of the greatest interpreters of the Great American Songbook. He died Friday at age 96. I hope you'll join us. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our co-host is Tanya Mosley. I'm Terry Gross.
I just got an invitation through the mails. Your presence requested this evening. It's formal, a top hat, a white tie, and tails. Nothing now could take the wind out of my sails. Because I'm invited to step out this evening with top hat and white tie and tails. I'm putting on my top hat, tying up my white tie, brushing off my tails. I'm doing up my shirt front, putting in the shirt studs, polishing my nails.
Why is everyone so obsessed with traditional wives or trad wives on social media? This week, we're talking about the viral videos of women making marshmallows and mozzarella from scratch, and how behind the sheen of calm kitchens and cute fits, there's some interesting pessimism about our modern world. And that's worth digging into. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Why did Cola Scola write a bonkers, extremely fictionalized play about Mary Todd Lincoln?
Well, you know, it was 2020 and we were all so isolated. I just started doing research. But the truth is, I just thought of it.
We'll talk about that and more on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.